books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, another narrator special. We'll hear the reasons why two narrators read for RNIB. We'll hear when a narrator met the author of an epic book, and we've got the books of your life from author Tia Fisher. All that coming up on today's Read On. In today's show, two authors and three narrators. First up, we hear from two audiobook narrators who read for RNIB and the reasons why. Here's Red Sail.
I'm delighted to be joined today in the studio by Kate Akello. Would you like to tell us how you became a talking books narrator?
So it's quite a personal thing for me, but I grew up with a blind mother and a blind uncle. Very, very capable people, very proud of them, but they were also avid readers when they could see. And so obviously when they lost their sight, it was very important to them that they still had the books that they enjoy reading. I was brought up always hearing talking books. When mum's ironing, when mum's in the bath, when mum's working out, she always has a talking book on. And to be honest, she can stay up until about 4 a.m. listening to them. They're addictive. And I realised as I got older how much an important thing it is for her to have that available to her, that really it would be silly if I didn't approach that as a skill that maybe I could help out with. The first time that my mum heard the audiobook, she found it online at 2 a.m. and I went into her bedroom and saw a very bleary-eyed, tired mother who decided that because it was my first audiobook, she had to stay up the entire night listening to it. And actually it was just such an emotional moment, really, because for some people it's, you know, it's just an audio book, but for me it's the only time that my mum gets to really see everything that I do as its whole. Obviously on stage there's always some visuals missing, but an audio book, it's just you, it's just the voice, and it's just the story. And so my mum experiencing that and being able to give that gift to her, and my uncle as well, was really, really special. And I'm so glad that I knocked on those doors and sent those emails.
One of the things I love about having professional actors reading the talking books is you are our eyes, and you're the person who puts the nuance into the voices and brings them alive and off the page.
When you do read a book, I must develop about 70 different accents in my head, and you always have voices for different characters. I remember in my audition for Here, I decided that I'd show them all the accents that I could do, so I chose a court scene of a book called Vernon Godlittle, where everybody was being questioned. And basically, I think we had an African in there, we had someone from Scotland, but actually, the more variation you can get, the more realistic it is to how you'd imagine it.
Do you have a favourite accent?
Well, I was born and bred in Newcastle, so I do kind of enjoy going back into the northeast accent when I can. I think it's always important that as an actor and a reader that you remember your roots and that you appreciate them and you nurture them as often as possible.
And what are you reading at the moment?
Amy Wilde, and it's by Helen Skelton, who actually, if people watched Blue Peter maybe a couple of years ago, she did a lot of the comic relief and the sports relief things. She did Thousands of Miles in the Amazon Forest. So this is actually set in the Amazon. A young girl from the northeast goes with her Aunt Marge, and we're about to find out all the adventures and the mischief that she gets up to. She's quite a naughty kid, which I...
Can you relate to that?
I can relate to that a little bit, but...
From a novice to an old hand...
I am very much an old hand.
I'm delighted to be joined by a voice that is not only familiar to me, but I hope to many of our listeners, Penelope Freeman.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So tell me, what have you been reading?
I have just actually finished The Inheritance by Jenny Pitman. It's a tale of doping and double dealing and sabotage and all kinds of other things. But yeah, it's been good fun.
I can't wait. That'll be one to brighten up the winter's evenings. So how did you start as a narrator for talking books?
Very, very simply, actually. I had a partially sighted grandmother. We were always trying to get her to listen to talking books. So I applied to the talking book studios. I wrote and I wrote and I bombarded and didn't get seen. And then finally I did, and sadly that coincided with my father becoming partially sighted. And my mum, who was an avid reader, got addicted to them too, so they would sit side by side and listen to talking books. It's just been historically in my family, and I like as many times as I can to come into the studios and do it. I do it professionally elsewhere.
And do you have a favourite genre that you like to read, or will you tackle anything?
I tend to get stories that are quite women-centric. I would secretly like to do more kids' books.
It reminds us of that, those wonderful days when your mum would read to you before you went to bed. Mm. And a good and sympathetic reading is one of the most comforting things I think you can have.
It's lovely for all kinds of reasons, because it does unscramble your brain. You just put your, you know, there's nothing worse than going to bed, putting your head on the pillow and thinking, oh, what have I got to do tomorrow? And, oh, I didn't kind of do that today or whatever. And you end up not going to sleep. I'm sure it's sleepless nights. People have them all the time because they are constantly having busy brains now. And it's a wonderful way of giving your brain a massage. That's the best way I can describe it.
So have there ever been books where you've read the first few chapters and just gone, I actually can't do this, and you've had to hand them back to the Talking Books Library and say, give me something else?
As a narrator, no. There was one I was very close to again, and I realised I was finding it quite disturbing. And it was only when I got a little bit further on in the preparation that I realised somebody had also been prepping the book, and they clearly had got to a point in the book where the prep, the pencil marks on the page had gone, and I realised that that was the point that they had probably given the book back. I thought, well, if RNIB had had difficulty already getting a narrator, and this clearly was one that was on the list to be recorded, I had to overcome that.
You were talking about the pencil marks in the margin. Mm. I've always wondered how the narrators keep the continuity. Do you keep notes at the front of the book?
Every reader does it differently, and every reader uses a different format. I read a book twice before I record it. The first is just to get a gist of the story, to get an idea of the pace of it and the genre and everything. And then the second, where I sit down and every single character I write out. And then the other thing I always do, the day of a recording, I go through the entire cast of characters. I try and remember as many as I can and put a voice to each one of them.
I always think that the narrators are discovering the plot at the same pace as I am, so not to bring in any vocal spoilers is quite an art, I should imagine.
Strangely enough, in a way, it's not. You have to be in the moment. You have to make it now. When it gets exciting, your voice changes and you're going, oh, this is about to happen and that's about to happen. Blah, blah, blah. And you modulate accordingly, but you have to be in the moment to do it. Hopefully, it stays fresh that way.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Thanks again to Red Seal. Coming up later, we'll hear about the narration of the epic tale Ducks Newburyport. But first, let's take a visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. We recently acquired A True Account, Hannah Missouri's Sojourn Among the Pirates, written by herself, by Catherine Howe. And despite the title, it is in fact historical fiction.
I don't know what made me determined to go to the hanging. I'd always made a point of avoiding them. I resisted the entreaties of my friends, who wanted to be in amongst the throngs of onlookers, ears pricked for the last words and the pious advice of the soon-to-be damned. Of course, I'd always been curious. You cannot help but wonder about the face of one condemned. To see his carriage toward the crowd and himself. To feel the swelling cheers and cries of all the townsfolk. To hear the crack of the felon's neck, snapped like a chicken's. I wondered if their eyes were open or closed when their moment came. What happens in the instant in between being a living, breathing creature, trembling with needs and wants and fears, and being an empty sack of flesh and bone? Is it the same for an old woman alone in her bed, with the covers pulled up tight, as it is for a man mounting the scaffold before God and everyone? Does an unearthly light of heaven attained shine upon the greasy strings of their hair if they have confessed and repented? Everyone repents at the end. Or so I've been told. I'd heard the moment of public death described often enough, usually by someone with a hand around a glass. But I had always been of too delicate a nature to see for myself. I didn't like to drown kittens or stomp tremble-whiskered mice and, as often as not, found a way to avoid such grim chores on the occasion Mrs. Tomlinson chose to impose them on me. I even crossed the street from dogs lying dead in the gutter. But something about William Fly was different. I made up my mind that I would go.
In Boston, as the golden age of piracy comes to a bloody close, Hanny Mazuri, bound into service at a waterfront inn since childhood, is ready to take her life into her own hands. When William Fly is hanged for piracy in the town square, the teenage Hannah is watching. Forced to flee for her life, Hannah disguises herself as a cabin boy and joins the pitiless crew of another notorious real-life pirate, Edward Ned Lowe. To earn her freedom and finally change the tide of her own future, Hannah must hunt down William Fly's lost treasure. Meanwhile, in 1930, Professor Marion Beresford pieces this bewitching story together, seeing her own lack of freedom reflected back at her as she watches Hannah's transformation. At the centre of Hannah Mazuri's account, however, lies a centuries-old mystery that Marion is determined to solve.
Summer wears long on the Boston wharves, with early sunrise and late nightfall dragging its feet to deliver our relief. And so, the afternoon was stifling in Ship Tavern when I first heard the name of William Fly. The Ordinary was generally tolerably cool in summer, being a dim cavern of rooms built of ancient brick, squatting like a naiad's grotto for almost 100 years at the foot of Clark's Wharf. Ship Tavern stands close enough to the harbor waters that a brig can moor nearly at the lip of our door. Well situated to swallow up the passing seamen as they stumble ashore, land sick and looking for all the things sailors look for when they have been long at sea. But that June day, the sun shone especially heavy, bleaching the color out of the air and leaving us all wilted and damp. Inside, the usually cool hollow of the larger dining room had warmed by degrees, until it felt like the inside of a beehive oven. The sand on the floor was hot underfoot. The front door stood propped open to catch any whisper of a passing breeze, but the water in Boston Harbor was as flat and slick as molten glass.
A True Account, Hannah Mazuri's Sojourn Among the Pirates, written by herself, by Catherine Howe, is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Petrie Burchard.
We have a brand new crime series by Mark Billingham. The Last Dance was donated by Little Brown.
Dressing slowly, like it was something he'd all but forgotten how to do, he listened to some irritating rent-a-gob sounding off about the state of the NHS on Capital Lancashire, so he argued with him, same as he always did, muttering or occasionally shouting at the radio. It was a daft habit that had become a kind of ritual, whatever the host or caller or so-called expert happened to be pontificating about, and Miller always enjoyed it. He put on pants and socks, then picked out a shirt.
And you can't get an appointment to begin with, not unless you've got one leg hanging off or you're an immigrant or something.
You're an idiot, mate. On second thoughts, I take that back because it's insulting to idiots.
Meet Detective Miller. Unique, unconventional, and criminally underestimated. He's a detective, a dancer, he has no respect whatsoever for authority, and he's the best hope Blackpool has for keeping criminals off the streets. A double murder in a seaside hotel sees grieving Miller return to work to solve what appears to be a case of mistaken identity. Just why were two completely unconnected men taken out? With a distinctly loose relationship with reality and a new partner to deal with, can eccentric, offbeat Miller find answers where more traditional police have found only an impossible puzzle?
As conversations went, Miller was fully aware that these chinwags were somewhat one-sided, but that wasn't the point. Along with the ratty chit-chat, it got his brain moving in the morning, or at least moving in the right direction, and it reminded him what his voice sounded like. He needed the kick of that and the distraction. He needed the noise. Truth be told, he also argued with the radio in the afternoons, and in the evening, middle of the night quite often, but that wasn't the point. A few minutes later, wearing a jacket that more or less matched the trousers, he stood in front of the large mirror next to the front door. He tried out a few expressions until what passed for a smile didn't seem too scary. He had a bash at a couple of casual nods and shrugs that he was hoping would do the trick. After the habitual brief skirmish with his hair, he settled for a draw and turned back towards the multi-level cage cum playpen that had cost him a small fortune and now took up most of the living room floor. He gave the rats a twirl.
"So what do you reckon? I think it's going to have to do."
Predictably, Fred and Ginger were otherwise occupied chasing each other from one end of the cage to the other. Miller tried not to take their lack of interest as a bad sign and turned to pick up Alex's mobile phone, which was lying there where it always was, plugged in on a table by the door. That sparkly red case, which looked nice enough, but, like he'd told her 100 times, would have been totally useless if she ever dropped her phone. Not that she ever did drop the bloody thing, certainly not as often as Miller dropped his, because she was always careful. But that wasn't the point.
The Last Dance by Mark Billingham is available from RNIB Talking Books as narrated by David Threlfall. In the RNIB Talking Book Studios, some books are easier to narrate than others. Let's listen in as a narrator talks to an author about an epic title.
Hi. So, do we just sort of start chatting, I think?
What happens when an author meets the person narrating their book for the first time?
Can I very quickly ask you about just a couple words I wondered about? So one thing I couldn't find, and I wondered if it was your own invention, is funette.
Oh, yeah. Is that like...
Lucy Ellman is an American-born British novelist based in Edinburgh. Her book, Ducks Newburyport, was on the shortlist for the Booker Prize. And so, thanks to the Booker Foundation, accessible audio braille and giant print versions were made by RNIB.
So what does it mean?
Cute things.
Cute things, yes. Are funette. And is that the way to pronounce it, is funette?
Yep.
The audio version took slightly longer than normal, though, as the book is a 1,000-page plus stream of consciousness and is told in just 8 sentences.
So one thing you have where one word sounds like another is you say innuendo, and then a word we couldn't find, inundo.
That comes from the Philadelphia story where this wonderful child comes in right at the beginning. I forget her name, and she says the newspapers are full of inundo.
So we said it right accidentally.
Oh, good.
Great. Inundo, fantastic.
The narrator for the RNIB recording is Stephanie Ellen, an American actor and narrator based in London. She met Lucy Ellman at the RNIB Talking Book Studios during the recording of Ducks Newburyport. And as well as clarifying some pronunciations, they allowed us to eavesdrop on their conversation.
So, Lucy, I heard an interview yesterday. You read a bit of the book yourself. And then I started to get a bit nervous because some writers aren't very good at reading aloud their own stuff. But I should have guessed, because of how incredibly fluent the flow of this book is, that you would be a good reader. And indeed, I thought, seriously, for a minute I thought, oh, they got an actress to do that. Let's see if she does better than me. And then I realized it was you, and I was like, oh, no. Because if you can read well, and you can out loud, then obviously you might have more ideas and be more critical about what you hear. So that made me a bit nervous. But
well, I love the way you're doing it. And as for that reading, I can only read if I practice and practice. And it's just a short passage. It takes me a day to prepare for that.
But did you, when you were writing, would you just stop and read it for rhythm? Or do you kind of hear the voice in your head as you go?
I think I hear it in my head. I think I've always read everything like that. I hear, that's why I'm a slow reader. I hear things. I have to hear the words in my head. It's pathetic.
No, I think it's fantastic because it's very poetic. And one of the things that happens over and over in this is our wonderful unnamed narrator, but actually I feel like an eavesdropper, because it's not like she's trying to tell us a story. We're eavesdropping and finding out all these things. And I think recognizing exactly how human thought really does work in this way, so often associative, isn't it? So I found often when the character's talking about her mother and thinking about her mother and maybe getting a little bit too upset, kind of like how the mountain lion comforts herself when she's frightened by purring. So she starts reciting things like lists of, you know, beautiful foods that she likes or what she has to do when she goes to the... So sort of in a way, not getting too upset because she doesn't want the children to see her that way, etc. And then often words that have something to do with these she's thinking of, but then another word that has nothing to do with that topic but sounds like it, has the same rhythm, or it rhymes with it, or the letter's the same. And I loved that poetry, involuntary poetry, and I think a lot of our thoughts actually are guided that way more than we think.
I don't know. It was one idea I had of how things might work. It's sort of hard to, you know, remember how your thoughts work.
It is.
Replay it or recreate it. Yeah, so it's sort of guesswork.
So in doing that, has that made you really just think about the process of thought more deeply? And do you find even that your own thoughts have started to change because you know the tricks in a way?
No, I haven't noticed that. But I've been on vacation since I finished this book.
Oh, my God, deserved.
I don't even remember my dreams anymore at the moment. It's like once this, I turned this off, my whole brain kind of relaxed and went on vacation.
I can imagine. You know how, well, maybe I know some duller people than you do, but often if someone tells me they're going to tell me what they dreamt, my heart sinks because they're dull,
oh, God,
right? They're very dull. But these dreams are not dull. They're absolutely hilarious. And I've been doing that sort of amateur Freudian thing of trying to see if in the dream, because see, I've read ahead now. I know what happens at the end, which I won't let on. So I'm kind of looking for presentiments that at some level she understands some threats in her environment and that's coming out in the dream. I haven't found that so far, but I'm doing a lot of sort of guesswork, like, could that mean this or that mean that? How did you come up with these dreams in the book?
Well, how I place them, it would take me a long time to dissect. But I do hate dreams in books in particular. And if a friend wants to tell me a dream, okay, one dream, I hope it's short. But in a book, I can't stand it at all. But I just thought, if they're concise enough, they can be really funny. You're right.
Yeah.
So I liked that. And I do sometimes think about dreams in the morning, if I haven't gone straight to the internet or something. And that's when they sort of bubble up while you're just waking up, doing things around the house, you know, and things come back to you about the dream. So I wanted to imply that stuff.
So when you wrote, it's just such a mystery to me how this vast undertaking has knit together so well. Did you sort of write different sections and then find ways to put them together later? Or was it absolutely just flow from beginning to end?
Oh, no. No. Sections and then putting them together like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And that took years.
I truly am so impressed by the audacity of it, do you know? Because after, I guess, Joyce, I don't know how many people actually try to do this.
I never intended to do something like this. It just turned into that project.
So at the beginning, did you not, in a way, not know what you were writing yet, and it revealed itself to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, yeah. I wanted to write something about animals. I wasn't particularly set on it being a lion, and I wanted to write about mothers, and I wanted to express my total despair, as usual. So I had to find a way to do all that.
I think you really did accomplish all those things.
Thank you.
It is amazing. Like, I really have thought so much more deeply about, yes, indeed, animals, wild animals, so little a part of so-called civilized life, as though they're cartoons to us almost. so much thought about animals, and just literally having to look up the names of lots of names I'd certainly never come across of different types of rodent or reptile. It really is an extraordinary education, and some of it a very disturbing one, and yet you want to know these things that have happened in America. This thing about all those massacres of the native peoples. I had known about some of them. I knew about the Trail of Tears and how appallingly the genocide, essentially, humans were treated. I hadn't all these particular ones, like
the Ohio ones.
Yeah.
I really scratched
the Janaden Hutton massacre, right? That was astonishing. And what's interesting is, you see, because it's her thoughts, she's not going, oh, yes, that thing that happened at Janaden Hutton, blah, blah, blah. It's like, at first, it's sort of in there as a teaser, and I looked it up to find out how it was pronounced, and then I got more of the details. So a lot of the things in there, now she does go into details about that later.
I think I did sort of think this is an internet age novel, and people can look up what they want. They don't have to, but they can if they want. So I'm not going to explain everything.
I don't think you should. And because we don't in our thoughts, do we?
No.
Except sometimes we'll be thinking obsessively. And that's how it struck me about the details of this particular massacre, because it's just so vivid to her. But I never get the feeling that you're like, okay, now I'm going to tell you something you don't know, reader, which is almost impossible not to do,
I suppose.
But you didn't. But there's quite a few things, like a lot of names of towns. And I would go to find the name of the town, and I would be looking at something out of Washington, D.C., reporting that a massacre had just taken place there. So there's this amazing method in what you're doing that some people might not ever want to. But if they do look it up, they'll see this thread. But in so many ways that you could have preached, and no one likes to be preached at, even if the sermon is worthwhile, you don't do that. Yeah. You don't preach. And yet, because of that, maybe it kind of sneaks up on us all the extraordinary and valid concerns about the environment and how animals are treated and how humans treat each other, gun violence in America. Like, Jim, the producer's then been working with me. We've both been, a lot of these things we think, well, that couldn't have happened. That's too ludicrous. You know, various shootings by police and just absurd things. And we'd look it up separately, and indeed, it's true. So many of the things are true. And I keep thinking maybe you slyly planted some things that aren't true, but we haven't found them
Fairly,
yet.
Fairly, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was based pretty much on what's, as far as I could tell, what's going on in that country.
Yeah. It's, was it important to you, the idea of having an audiobook version of this, so that visually impaired people would have a chance to experience the book? Was that something, I mean, once it was being published, did you think about that?
I wondered how my mother-in-law would be able to listen to it.
Oh.
Or get it, yeah. Because I don't think my father-in-law is really in the mood to read a 1,000-page book to her. But, it's very interesting work that goes on in this place. And I was really thrilled to hear that you could do it.
So many people, especially in the U.S., where people will often drive for 2 or 3 hours just to get to work, people listen to audiobooks, I think, maybe more than they actually read, you know, with their eyes in the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, they should stay home, read a book, save the environment.
Exactly.
But okay.
But you can also listen to an audiobook when you're washing the dishes or feeding. If you have those earpieces, you can listen while you're out feeding the chickens and things as well.
Yeah, that's allowed. Yeah.
And also, I think if something's daunting, like a very long book, let's say, if you are a bit daunted by it, if it's going into your ears, you know, somehow that takes any fear a person might have.
Yeah.
But I read something you told someone in an interview or something, and I totally see that now, is that in the end, it's like four average-sized books put together. And if you're a big reader, you would easily read four books in a fairly short space of time. So what's the problem?
I was really surprised. I mean, I was surprised how long it was when I finally put it all together. But I was also surprised that that was a big issue, because I thought only I hate long books.
What, do you hate long books?
Well, I'm scared of them because I'm so slow. Yes. So I have to be very
so
committed.
Interesting. Well, you really tackled that fear,
didn't
you? It's
not my usual style.
But see, I suppose, and that's funny, isn't it? Because, yes, I think sometimes I'll eye a book in a store, and if it is brick-like, I will sometimes go, not sure, because sometimes the reason people write really long books is they're being, as a writer, I believe, they're being sort of undisciplined and just sort of, oh, you know what I mean? They're kind of exulting in their own cleverness or something like that.
Or they don't know how to work a computer properly.
Yeah. Or they're just not very good at editing. And I do think maybe editing in the book trade is a dying art. But I swear to you, I don't get that from this, because you get more and more into it. I keep wanting to know more and more about what is going to happen to that mountain lion. You know, I'm so yearning for her to be all right. And what is going to happen in these various things? And uh-oh, are we being told about certain things because something's going to, you know, I'm crazy to find out what's going to happen.
Great.
Yeah. So.
Yes, I think part of the novelist's job is to drive you crazy. And that, yeah. I don't mind doing that.
Yeah.
I love what you said about the purring. I never really thought of it, but I think you're right.
Oh, how lovely.
She does comfort herself.
The fact that the raccoons are now banging an empty yogurt carton around on the driveway, the fact that in the early morning stillness it sounds like gunshots, the fact that even in fog, with ice on the road and snowbanks blocking their vision, people are already zooming around our corner, the site of many a minor accident. The fact that a guy in a pickup once accidentally skidded into our garage, and next time it could be our house or a child. Wake up picture day! Dicamba, Kleenex. The fact that a pickup truck killed Dilly. The fact that she'd successfully dodged cars for 3 whole years. The fact that she knew all about cars. But during that time, the traffic grew. The fact that it's crazy now. The fact that after Dilly got killed, the kids painted a big warning sign with a big black cat on it and stuck it right by the fence. But nobody notices it. The fact that they're all going too fast to see it. When the cat died, we had catnip tea. The fact that failure to yield causes 1 in 5 accidents in Ohio. The fact that car crashes are up 20% since 2009. And then what I wondered about was, it's the name of a creek or something? M-U-H-U-L-B-U-C-T-I-T-U-M, like Muhl.
Wow.
M-U.
I don't remember that.
H-U-L. B-U-C-T-I-T-U-M. So we said Muhlbuktitum. It's the name of a creek. Does that ring a bell?
Not at all.
Oh, great.
I'm sure you did find
it. Great, because that way, at least you won't be criticizing me like, that lazy actress did not find out the correct pronunciation.
I wouldn't be criticizing you at all. This is superb. We really like, we both
turned
to
pleased.
Each other. We were so pleased and relieved. And I mean, because one fears what might go wrong.
Yes.
But I don't know what could go wrong. But you have done it so well.
I think it's
well.
Inevitable that I will have mispronounced some things. But
everybody does.
No, here's a cap.
She might do.
Yes, of course. See, that's it. Of course. Because in our thoughts, we might very well often mispronounce things.
Autry, buckeye, black walnut, hickory, butternut. The fact that Stacy's old enough to handle the road, but the other kids aren't. The fact that a little boy was killed in his bed just the other day by a skidding car crashing into his house. Been asleep. The fact that there are 2 cardinals right now in the lilac tree. Brown sugar. The fact that 11% of Americans carry on driving when the fuel tank empty light comes on. The fact that, boy, you'd think it'd be more like 80%. Ronnie. Chicken feed. The fact that there are macrophages. The fact that I dreamt I flew all the way to India to get a teaspoon of cinnamon. But when I got home, I realized I needed flaked almonds, too. Security, holding pattern, go figure. Not in my backyard. Oh, the fact that we have to do our taxes and try to remember every little bit of income and expenditure. The fact that there was more of the latter than the former. Family Dollar, Zikers, password, username, Your card is now active and ready to use.
Coming up at the end of the show, we've got The Books of Your Life from author Tia Fisher. But now, let's return to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
The Book of Secrets by Anna Mazzola is inspired by real events that took place in 17th century Italy. It was given to us by Orion.
The angels stare, stone-eyed, at the casket. Their chiselled faces are smooth and untroubled, as they are throughout the many funerals, marriages and baptisms that take place beneath them every day. Mostly this past year it has been funerals, for the plague has swept through Rome and the mosaic of states that make up Italy. Now, though, the plague is silent, having burnt itself out. It is not plague that killed this man. On the floor of Santa Maria del Popolo, Girolamo watches the mourners as they walk past the body laid out for burial, bowing their heads, murmuring. Some touch the arm or gloved hand of the willow-tall young woman who stands near her dead husband's casket, her face shrouded in a black veil. Behind her waits another woman, older, broader, but with a similar bearing. This, Girolamo thinks, must be the widow's mother, for her protective gaze doesn't leave her daughter.
Rome, 1659. Months after the plague has ravished Rome, men are still dying in unnatural numbers, and rumour has it that their corpses do not decay as they should. The papal authorities commission prosecutor Stefano Bracci to investigate, telling him he will need considerable mettle to reach the truth. To the west of the Tiber, Girolamo and her female friends are at work, helping other women with childbirths and foretelling their futures. Elsewhere in the city, a young wife, Anna, must find a way to escape her abusive husband. But in a city made by men for men, there are no easy paths out. Stefano's investigation at the Tordenone prison will introduce him to horror, magic, and an astonishing cast of characters. He will be left wondering if certain deeds should remain forever unpunished.
There are two young men by the casket now. They're peering too closely, speaking in a manner not suited to a funeral, to the death of a man who died at just 30 years of age. Death might have ravaged Rome, the plague carrying off the good and the evil, the young and the old. But it has, in Girolamo's experience, not inured people to it. They still grieve as deeply as they ever did, each loss a puncture to the soul. These two young men, though, seem untouched by grief or pity. They might be visiting the waxworks at a fair. She hears one say, "What rosy cheeks! He looks better in death than he did in life. I'd say it rather suited him." Under her breath, she curses them, wishes them down to the devil. They know nothing. They understand nothing because they're young, confident males and haven't experienced what she has, nor what these women have. They have little idea what it takes to survive in a city made by and for men. She wishes that the earth would swallow them up. But there's only one man who's going into the ground today, and he is long past caring.
The Book of Secrets by Anna Mazzola is available from RNIB Talking Books, as narrated by Genevieve Gaunt.
Paris 44, The Shame and the Glory by Patrick Bishop was given to us by Penguin Random House.
In the early summer of 1945, the maternity wards of Paris were suddenly very busy. The upsurge in births was a living, breathing legacy of what had been the party of the century, that glorious Friday in August 1944, when Paris was liberated from the Germans, setting off an explosion of happiness that echoed round the world. The American war reporter Ernie Pyle arrived by jeep to witness a pandemonium of surely the greatest mass joy that has ever happened. We all got kissed until we were literally red in face, and I must say we enjoyed it. when the jeep was simply swamped in human traffic and had to stop. We were swarmed over and hugged and kissed and torn at. Everybody, even beautiful girls, insisted on kissing you on both cheeks. The fact that I hadn't shaved for days and was grey-bearded as well as bald-headed made no difference. Among the population, the longing for deliverance was so deep that some feared at first that the American uniforms in the streets must be a hallucination. But no, I am not dreaming, wrote a middle-aged man of letters, Gustave Jean Rebaz, in his diary. The nightmare of occupation is finally at an end, and Paris has rolled away the stone of its own tomb and is reborn again.
When the Germans marched in and the lamps went out in the City of Light, the millions who loved Paris mourned. Liberation 4 years later triggered an explosion of joy and relief. It was the party of the century and everybody who was anybody was there. General Charles de Gaulle seized the moment to create an instant legend that would take its place alongside the great moments in French history. After years of oppression and humiliation, Parisians had risen to reclaim their city and drive out the forces of darkness, or so the story went. This fresh new account of the liberation, packed with revelation, tells the story of those heady days of suspense, danger, exhilaration, and vengeance through the eyes of a range of participants reflecting all sides of the conflict, Americans, French, and Germans, resistors and collaborators. Among them are famous names like Ernest Hemingway, J.D. Salinger, and Pablo Picasso, and also some fascinating unknowns, including a medic-turned-resistance gunman, an androgynous Hungarian sculptor, and a French bluestocking who quietly set about saving the nation's art treasures from the Nazi looters. Paris 44 looks behind the mythology to tell the real story of the liberation and expose the conflicts and contradictions of France under the occupation, the shame, as well as the glory. This gripping wartime narrative will enthrall anyone who has a place for Paris in their hearts.
The eruption of exhilaration and relief reflected the unique position that Paris held in the world's affections. Its fate mattered to almost everybody. In November 1939, 3 months into the strange interlude of inaction before fighting erupted in the West, which the French called the Drôle de Guerre, and the British, the phony war, Maurice Chevalier recorded a reassuring song. Paris sera toujours Paris was a message to the world that whatever Hitler threw at the place, Paris will always be Paris. The verses described the boarded-up statues, taped-over windows, gas masks, rationing, air raid sirens, and blackouts now marring the beauty of everyone's favourite city. But the refrain promised, in spite of all the gloom and dark, the city we all love, you'll see, will never ever lose her spark. Paris will always be Paris. The more they dim the lighting, the more we'll come back fighting, our spirit and our humour floating free. Paris will always be Paris.
Paris 44, The Shame and the Glory by Patrick Bishop is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Peter Noble.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to Lynn Livingston.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Back in June, we heard from the shortlisted Yozo Carnegie authors, including eventual winner of the Shadow Wars Award, Tia Fisher. You can hear our chat about her book, Crossing the Line, in Read On episode 375. But here's something we recorded at the time but didn't have time for during the coverage of the Yozo Carnegie's The Books of Your Life from Tia Fisher. She spoke to Toby Davey.
Was there a book from your childhood that made you sort of fall in love with reading and writing?
I am going to cheat on this. So there were two books. One of them encouraged me to read, one of them encouraged me to write, and they were about 6 years apart.
I can still remember sitting in my parents' bed when I was 5. I was ill and I was allowed to be in their bed, and I was reading the Ladybird version of The Little Red Hen. And it was the first book that I read all the way through. And I had been late to read. In my family, 5 was late to read. You know, all the other kids were reading at sort of 3.5 and 4. And I wasn't. And I was really conscious of this, which gives me a kind of empathic key into what it feels like to be the one in the class who's not a good reader. And I got to the end of the book. And I can still remember this rush of emotion and pride and joy. And after that, you couldn't stop me reading. You could not stop me reading. I just read all the time. So that was my reading book. You know, it wasn't about the book. It was about the accomplishment. But then when I was 10 or 11, my dad handed me a poem by Dylan Thomas, the Welsh poet. And he said, "I'm curious to know what you think of this." And I'd never really read poetry beyond a little bit in school. And he handed it to me and I read Fern Hill, which is the most beautiful poem. I recommend anybody to go and read it. And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "It sings." And it did. And it was the first time that I discovered that just the sound, even without understanding the semantics and necessarily really getting what it meant, just the sound of language could make you fall in love and give you massive pleasure. So poetry for me, when you combine the sound with what it means, just it's like singing.
Fern Hill. Now, as I was young and easy under the apple boughs about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb, golden in the heydays of his eyes. And honoured among wagons, I was prince of the apple towns. And once below a time, I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. And as I was green and carefree, famous among the barns about the happy yard, and singing as the farm was home in the sun that is young once only, time let me play and be golden in the mercy of his means. And green and golden, I was huntsman and herdsman. The calves sang to my horn. The foxes on the hills barked clear and cold. And the Sabbath rang slowly in the pebbles of the holy streams. All the sun long, it was running, it was lovely, the hayfields high as the house, the tunes from the chimneys, it was air and playing, lovely and watery and fire green as grass. And nightly under the simple stars as I rode to sleep, the owls were bearing the farm away. All the moon long I heard, blessed among stables, the nightjars flying with the ricks, and the horses flashing into the dark. And then to awake, and the farm like a wanderer white with the dew, come back, the cock on his shoulder. It was all shining, it was Adam and maiden, the sky gathered again, and the sun grew round that very day. So it must have been after the birth of the simple light, in the first spinning place, the spellbound horses walking warm out of the whinnying green stable, onto the fields of praise. And honoured among foxes and pheasants by the gay house, under the new-made clouds, and happy as the heart was long, in the sun born over and over, I ran my heedless ways. My wishes raced through the house-high hay, and nothing I cared at my sky-blue trades, that time allows in all his tuneful turning, so few and such morning songs, before the children, green and golden, follow him out of grace. Nothing I cared in the lamb-white days, that time would take me up to the swallow-thronged loft by the shadow of my hand, in the moon that is always rising, nor that riding to sleep I should hear him fly with the high fields and wake to the farm forever fled from the childless land. Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea.
Sean Probert, reading from A Dylan Thomas Treasury, Poems, Stories and Broadcasts. Available from RNIB Talking Books.
Is there a book that you could happily sort of curl up with on a rainy day as a reread?
Yes, I totally love Patrick Ness's book, A Monster Calls. It's a teen read, and it's one of the very few books where they've actually made a brilliant film from it. So it works really well in book or film. I advise you to do both. And it's desperately sad. The first time I read it, I finished it sitting in Stansted Airport, waiting for my dad to arrive on a plane. And when he met me, I was just bawling my head off. Because, I mean, no spoilers, but it is incredibly emotional. And Patrick Ness, it wasn't originally his book. It was an idea by a lady called Siobhan Dowd, who died before she could finish it. And he sort of knew her vaguely and was given this book to complete and has written it with total respect for her. And when you read the storyline, which is about a mother dying, and when you know what was happening to Siobhan Dowd as she was coming up with it, it's just, oh, it's brilliant. And it's magical realism. It combines reality with magic so beautifully. It's a perfect read. I recommend it to anybody.
Monsters showed up just after midnight, as they do. Connor was awake when it came. He'd had a nightmare. Well, not a nightmare, the nightmare. The one he'd been having a lot lately. The one with the darkness and the wind and the screaming. The one with the hands slipping from his grasp, no matter how hard he'd tried to hold on. The one that always ended with, "Go away!" Connor whispered into the darkness of his bedroom, trying to push the nightmare back, not let it follow him into the world of waking. "Go away now!" He glanced over at the clock his mum had put on his bedside table. 12:07. 7 minutes past midnight. Which was late for a school night. Late for a Sunday, certainly. He told no one about the nightmare. Not his mum, obviously. But no one else either. Not his dad in their fortnightly or so phone call. Definitely not his grandma. And no one at school. Absolutely not. What happened in the nightmare was something no one else ever needed to know. Connor blinked groggily at his room. Then he frowned. There was something he was missing. He sat up in his bed, waking a bit more. The nightmare was slipping from him. But there was something he couldn't put his finger on. Something different. Something... He listened, straining against the silence. But all he could hear was the quiet house around him. The occasional tick from the empty downstairs or a rustle of bedding from his mum's room next door. Nothing. And then something. Something he realised was the thing that had woken him. Someone was calling his name. Connor. He felt a rush of panic, his guts twisting. Had it followed him? Had it somehow stepped out of the nightmare and... Don't be stupid, he told himself. You're too old for monsters. And he was. He'd turned 13 just last month. Monsters were for babies. Monsters were for bedwetters. Monsters were for Connor.
That's Helen Dickens reading A Monster Calls by Patrick Ness. Available from RNIB Talking Books.
And is there something that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
So I've just done a master's degree in writing for young people. And at the start of that, we were recommended to read a list of books. And one of the books was by one of the tutors. It's a book called Blood Moon by Lucy Cuthew. And it's a verse novel. And it's about a 15-year-old girl who is period shamed. She's shamed by the school for being on her period. And it's the most brilliant political, polemic, feminist book, and it's written amazingly, and it taught me so much about verse novels and what you could do with text and what you could do with voice. And I owe a massive debt to it, and I recommend everybody to, well, not everybody necessarily, but particularly young readers to go out and read that book because it's a stonker.
I perch on the bench in the planetarium staff room and take out my phone with its smooth black and gold star-spangled case and read all the messages from today while I wait, listening to the silent room, checking it's empty before I get changed. There's a message from Dad, and a ton in the chat, with the girls called Beans on Toast, the only thing any of us can cook. Dad, I will be the one in the white Ford behind the trees at 00:05. D. Kiss. I think he's being funny, but I don't get it. He's on another planet. At least he's agreed to pick me and Harriet up, around the back, and not inside the ice rink like he wanted to. I open Beans on Toast. Harriet, just getting ready? Bethany, remind me why we're going to an ice rink birthday party? Are we 10 again? Layla, apparently it's free because Jackson's on the ice hockey team, but it's totally so he can show off to everybody. Harriet, he can show off to me. Apparently he's amazing. Bethany, I thought you fancied Lee. Harriet, I can multitask. Bethany, lol. I'm secretly quite up for it. Marie, I'm openly up for it. It'll be fun. Harriet, what are you all wearing? Layla, shorts and a crop top and a massive hoodie to get past the parent police. Marie, Lay, ice skating? I'm wearing two pairs of leggings and a vest under my dress. Layla, ugh, changing now. Warm clothes are so unflattering on me. At least I'll be allowed out. Harriet, you always look lovely. Has anyone heard from Frankie today? Me. I'm here. Just finishing work. Tell me when you're there. Kiss, kiss.
Blood Moon by Lucy Cuthue is available in audio commercially, as narrated by Harry Dolby.
And thank you so much for chatting with me here on Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer. That we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2pm or 10pm if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.